This episode is sponsored by GameGenic. Episode 41 of the Board Game Geek Podcast, where we geek out about board games, the mechanisms behind them, and the people who create them. I'm your host, Candace Harris, and I'm super excited to be here today with Suzanne Sheldon from the Salt and Sass Games Twitch, YouTube channel, and podcast. How's everything going with you today, Suze?
It's amazing because I'm here recording with you. I have to say, I was pretty tickled when I got invited to be part of the podcast. One, because I think you're amazing and I love Board Game Geek and I think the podcast is great and you have an amazing lineup of guests. And two, my co-host on Salt and Sass was already on it and just, you know, a little like, oh, wait a minute.
You know, I try to, like, I always like breaking up pairs.
Yes, absolutely.
And like right now in a similar situation, I had Monique on from Before You Play, but I haven't had Naveen yet. Ooh. So it's like I'm trying to spread it out. But yeah, every time like I see you at Gen Con or somewhere, I'm like, we got to do an episode together. So finally it is happening.
Yes, and I am stoked for sure. And
awesome.
And so thank you for that. And I just got off a weekend of playing a ton of games locally here. And it once again, I had this moment of I was physically tired. And you know, I'm getting up there in age and all this other stuff. And I was my eyes are tired and things like that.
Yeah.
But I was so jazzed up by playing these games. And I just kept on thinking, like, oh, I wish we had played that. Oh, I wish we had played, you know, this other thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just one of those funny things about board games. I never get tired of it. And I never get tired about talking about it. We played a game just on Tuesday night. And, you know, it's one of those things where you take 2 hours to play the game and then you take an hour to talk about the game afterwards.
Yes, I love that.
So being on this podcast with you, it's just all part of that wonderfulness.
Yes. I love talking to people who are also enthusiastic and excited about board games together. And that's so cool. Yeah, I know what you mean about being able to just kind of keep playing back-to-back games. And it's funny because my partner, Matt, will always be like, he's like, yeah, after a game, you're always like, all right, what are we playing next? And he's like, that's enough. You know, one game is enough. And I'm like, no, let's go. No. What's next? What's next? I'm thinking about the next game sometimes when I haven't even finished the first one. Guilty of that.
I love it.
Well, anyway, today we're going to be talking about some meaty games in small packages, like games that are in smaller than average size boxes, but that pack a bit of punch. Like, and usually it's like kind of in an unexpected way. Like, wow, I did not expect to have such an experience from a game in a little tiny box.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much you share in general about behind the scenes of recording this podcast. But when you reached out, you said, hey, here are some topics that I want to, you know, I'm looking to cover in the future, which ones appeal to you. And I was reading the list and I saw meaty games in small packages and my heart went, whoa. And I was trying to be a polite guest too. So I was kind
of. So you gave me a couple options.
Yeah. I was like, well, this one pops out at me, but I would also love to talk about these other topics. But inside, I was my brain was going, ooh, meaty games, small boxes, please, please.
Yeah.
So I was very excited that we get to talk about this one because it's games come in such a wide breadth and depth. And I think, you know, especially in America and maybe in Europe a little bit, where packaging size influences things like how much you can charge for a game or perceptions,
right?
That judge a book by its cover kind of thing. I always feel like small games sometimes kind of maybe fairly or unfairly set a certain zone of expectations.
Mm.
And so the subversiveness of a smaller box, but you get that chonk in what's inside. I love that. I think that's super fun.
Awesome. I think almost for probably 90% of these podcast episodes, I have sent my guest co-host for the episode like a couple of different options, just like I did, because I like when you're excited about something too, because it's like, you know, I have all these ideas of stuff I want to talk about, but like if something resonates with you, like let's talk about it. So I was glad that this one kind of jumped out at you.
Absolutely. And I think it just tags, and it's one of those things on our podcast, Salt and Sass, we do something called the game pie at the end, because Mandy and I hate ranking. Like fans love things like top five, top 10 lists. And that's great. There's nothing wrong with them. It's just they make Mandy and I, we're very uncomfortable ranking things that way.
Yeah.
So we kind of developed this game pie of like, here's just a serving of games in a topic that we like. And that's just cool. Like doing our game pies, once I started digging in, okay, now I've got my topic. What games do I want to talk about?
Right.
And I just, my list kept on growing and growing and growing. I'm like, oh, and this one and that one. And I got to the point where I'm like, oh, it's really hard to cut down now. Uh-oh. Because I think in general, you know, that unexpected game in a little box, it hits on a couple of zones that I'm fairly excited about. So one of those zones is solo gaming. I love solo gaming. And
yes,
sometimes in little boxes, you can get little surprises for a solo experience.
For sure.
And another area it really toggles is games from Asia. Because packaging norms are a little different in that region than they are in the Western world of board games. And they're harder to get. And sometimes they're not. You know, all this other. There's a little few more complexities in finding out and spreading the word about games out of Asia for a variety of reasons. But there are so many great games in tiny boxes that, you know, do a little more. So I just was spinning out of control.
Yeah. And as you were just talking there, like I was starting to think of other games that I missed. It's wild. But anyway, before we start talking about meaty games in small packages, I'd love to hear what you've been playing lately, Suzanne. So let's jump into Fresh Plays.
All right. Well, I just got a surprise review copy, which is always delightful, especially when it's a game I'm excited about. It just showed up, and I know that that sounds like really privileged, and it is. And that is Tangram City. I am a huge polyomino tile laying game fan in general, and I'd seen a brief post about Tangram City pop up in my social media feed, and I was like, oh. And I actually wasn't expecting to get a review copy at all, but here it is. This is being published this year, 2024. And hey, Candace, it's designed by Uwe Rosenberg.
Nice.
Yeah, right? Oh, that guy. It is published by Korea Board Games. And I think in North America, it's being handled by Capstone Games.
Okay.
And it plays 1 to 5, which, as mentioned just a second ago, I love solo gaming too.
Yes.
So got this to the table. And I mean, it is quick and easy to pick up and teach every player. You got this whole box of all these different tangrams. And how do those vary? Well, now you've got triangles involved in these tiles. So you get this wild diversity of tile shapes, right? So you punch out all these tile shapes. There's a little deck of cards and you get your own player board. So in some ways, it's a little bit of bingo-y. Gotcha. But we'll talk about that in a second. So you're going to get all these tiles that are in a huge variety of shapes. And there's two sides to each tile. One has kind of a parks and greenery feel. And then one side has more of a city and a building feel to it, right? So there's darker side and greener side and that kind of thing. And then you have this deck of cards. And depending on the player count, they are dealt out in a slightly different way. And what this ultimately impacts is everybody will have access to play every card, but the order in which you get to access them is impacted by how they're dealt out. And then the cards are associated with a specific shape because everybody gets their own set of tiles and everybody gets the identical set of tiles. So that's where it's kind of bingo-y a little bit, right?
Gotcha.
Right? So the card flips over. You have a card in your hand and you just find that tile and you place it on your board. Go around. Then you have access to the next person's players. There's cards in the center, that kind of thing. Again, it's just look at the tile, look at the card, find the tile, put it on your board.
Got it.
At the end of every round, you are going to do a little bit of scoring. And ultimately, the first set of scoring you're going to do is, when all is said and done, what is the complete rectangle that you've managed to create? And you score that. So without any gaps. And again, you've got triangles. You've got halvesy squares in here.
Neat.
So you're going to count, oh, I managed to go four across and three down. Cool. That's 12 points. But then there's this other weird thing with balance. So you have green and those black sides, right?
Right, right.
So you're going to count how many squares of green you have and how many squares of black you have. At the end of the game, that's the quote-unquote balance. The closer your green count and your black count is together, the higher end game points you will get for that.
Ooh, that's cool.
Yeah, so it adds a little bit extra. You get bonus points if you manage to completely fill in your grid. I have not managed to do that. But, you know, that score exists. And it's so quick and easy to teach, and it plays really quickly. But that puzzle and figuring out these tiles, and there is some, you know, give and take about what side am I going to use? Well, and again, if you're flipping tiles, it changes the orientation of the tile a little bit. So maybe I really want it to be the green tile, but I got to flip it to make it fit the space.
The shape that I need. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Neat.
It works so great. I've only played it a couple of times so far. I can't wait to dig into it more, but it is an instant pop for me. I just love these types of games, and
awesome.
Tangram City is a really hit. Now, have you seen this yet, Candace?
You know, the name sounds familiar, but I can't even picture it.
I think it's pretty new.
Yeah. I'll have to check it out. I'm typically not super in love with tile placement.
Yep.
Believe it or not.
Like, no, that, totally fair.
I'm trying to think of which tile placement game I love or something. But yeah, that's never been something that kind of puzzle that I thrive on.
And
I think it's because I'm not good at it too.
I definitely have a friend in one of my game groups that is not spatially oriented. And they don't enjoy playing these types of games simply because it just doesn't click with them.
But I love that idea of having these triangles and trying to balance the dark and light side of the tiles for scoring. It's like a double layered puzzle there.
I mean, it's Uwe Rosenberg, of course. Even for a fairly straightforward game, he had to throw a little twist in.
Very cool. And so that's coming out later this year, you said?
Yep, that's coming out more publicly soon. And I believe this is just a preview copy. And check it out. It's Tangram City.
Cool. Very cool. Well, I was playing recently. First of all, Suze, I have been on a big Dune kick.
Oh, I've been listening. Yeah, I heard all about your uprising. Absolutely.
I am I've seen the movie, the new Dune Part 2, 3. I saw it 3 times in the theater.
Wait a minute. Last episode of the podcast, you'd only seen
two.
It twice.
Yeah.
I saw it again.
And I'm good for now. But like, I still, when I see it come up on like available for streaming on TV, I'm like tempted to just buy it. And I don't know, I can't get enough of it. I restarted reading Dune because at some point before the first new movie came out, I think I read about 120 pages and then I just kind of fell off. But now I'm like back into it and I'm loving reading it now with all of the extra details that are in the book that are not captured in the movie. So it's like all clicking in different ways. And yeah. So anyway, so whenever it was available on Kickstarter, I backed Dune: War for Arrakis. And for me, I was like, okay, I love Dune. And also I love War of the Ring. And two of the designers, Marco Maggi and Francesco Nipitello, designed War of the Ring. So I'm like, I'm getting 2/3 of that design team. So anyway, this shipped to backers, I believe, like I got my copy at the end of February 2024 this year. And this is published by Simon, plays with 1 to 4 players. And in this game, it is an asymmetrical battle. Like, this is more or less a war game for the planet Arrakis. You know, I think it's designed primarily as a 2-player game, but you can play it, like there's a mode where you can play it with 3 or 4, which I'm curious to try, but I'm assuming it's always going to shine best with 2, because one person is going to play House Harkonnen, the other person's going to play House Atreides. That was me in my game. My friend Jake was House Harkonnen. He loves the Sardaukar. And I always make him be like the quote unquote bad guys in whatever like kind of war game I play with him.
Noted.
But the Harkonnen player's goal is to get 10 supremacy points. And the main way that they do that is by harvesting spice. Very thematic. The other way is if they take over my Atreides sieges. So I have these different sieges that are on the board that have tokens with a rank underneath. And the rank is either going to be 1, 2, or 3. And so if the Harkonnen player takes over a siege that's rank 3, they get 3 supremacy points. But they don't know the rank of these because the tokens are face down under these minis. And then my goal as the Atreides player is to achieve a secret objective. So they have these different secret objective cards. And I have a prescience track. You like how I say I'm just associating myself with the Atreides.
Yes, absolutely.
All the time.
I picked up on that.
So there's a prescience track for the Atreides player. And there are 3 markers, like one that represents Paul realizing that he's, you know, going to be the Kwisatz Haderach. There's one that's like related to them being allies with the Fremen, the desert people. And then the other one is related to like the holy war that's going to happen. So, you know, there are these 3 tokens you're trying to push up. And, you know, in my case, I think there are 10 different secret objective cards. Mine was that I needed the Kwisatz Haderach marker on step 9. I needed the Sand Dwellers on 6 and the Holy War on 4. Jake doesn't know this. My opponent doesn't know this. They just know they're just seeing me trying to bump these markers up. And so I love that off the bat that they, you know, there's some intrigue. There's some, you know, mystery. But what is she trying to do? You know, he's wondering. Every single turn of this game, we both found to be like so tense. Like every move you make, it's just like, well, if I do that, they might do this. And man, it's so cool. So there's a big map with these different like different types of terrain, mostly desert, as you'd imagine if you know Dune. And then you just basically play through a series of rounds until one of you wins. And at the beginning of each round, you'll reveal these 3 cards from this deck of prescience cards. These are goals for the Atreides player. So the Atreides player, like ways for me to bump up those markers on the prescience track. Like some of them are end of round scoring. Some of them are like goals that I can complete during the round. And of course, they're public. Well, not of course, but they are public. And so, you know, my opponent knows what I'm going for. Like maybe I'm, you know, you can only score 2 of them each round, but it's public. And then you get these planning cards. These planning cards are great. They add even more spice to the game because you can play them to like break rules, to bring in like different leaders and everything. And the main system also, I guess just big picture, this is a CMON game. So we have minis. We have tons of minis. The minis are great because there are 3 different types of units. There are like regular units there, and they all have a little circular base. There are elite units with a square base. There are special elites that have an like kind of an octagon, I think. And then so you can tell easily who's who or which type of unit based on the base. And then there are leaders, and they are a slightly different color than the other one. So you can easily see, okay, those are leaders versus regular units and everything. So I think like that is really good. Like some of the buildings and everything, really good, like awesome, awesome production. The way you take actions is you roll some dice. There are action dice. That's going to tell you which actions you have access to. But there's like lots of flexibility within them. The asymmetry is so cool and very thematic. Like every round, the Harkonnen player gets to place a certain amount of vehicles out, like ornithopters, which can help them like move better. And also like scout territories to kind of like look at tokens that I have face down. They have harvesters, which that's where they're trying to get spice. But meanwhile, Atreides can place these worm sign tokens, which means a worm might spawn. And then that like helps their movement because they can move through adjacent spaces that have worm sign tokens or worms. And yeah, it's just super cool. Another thing that I love that was like so thematic is that the Atreides player, their units are secret at the beginning of the game. And when you deploy them, there are these tokens face down. So it kind of represents how like when they're popping out of the sand to attack. Yeah. And I was like, this is like freaking brilliant. And again, it adds more spice because if the Harkonnen player is coming to try to take a siege and I have two deployment tokens, they don't know. I could have some beefy units there, you know? So I could talk more and more about this for a while, but I'll just say overall, like it felt so thematic. We were both new. So our first round was kind of, I did a full teach and then our first round was kind of slow. You know, we're like making sure we're doing stuff, refer to rules. After that, we never needed to like really look at the rule book at all. Wow. And we were just like, the only thing that was time consuming was strategy and decisions. Cause there are so many like really, really, really cool decision points. And you're also, again, wondering what they're going to do, trying to prevent them. You're trying to hit your goal and everything. And I think our game was about like 3.5-4 hours. And it ended up being 4 rounds. So only 4 rounds. So I think I could get that down to like 2 to 3 hours, like when I'm playing with someone who knows
the game. Especially not with a teach. Yeah.
But I loved it. Like it exceeded my expectations. You know, I thought it was going to be good when I backed it, but then I was like reading some people talking about it and I was like, uh-oh, you know, people who were playing it on TTS. I was like, uh-oh, you know, but I was like, oh, it's a CMON game. I could always sell it if it's not, you know, if I don't love it, but I do love it. So
Great. I love how, honestly, listening to you talk about it, you're telling the story of the game. And I just, it did, like when you're talking about which mechanisms, whether it's the spice harvester or the way that the tokens are secret or the secret goals for House Atreides, like that is so thematic. And I think that that is really, really cool. And I find that I am not a theme person, right? I'm a cube pusher through and through. I don't care about, even when we're going through rule books, a lot of times we'll, in my game groups, we'll be like theme shmeme.
Yeah.
But I have found in certain games, and I think this sounds like one of them, the theme just propels you so much through the action. So you can say 3.5 or 4 hours, but I could totally see where those hours kind of speed by.
Yes. And we were playing the movie soundtracks.
Nice.
So it was actually really funny because like at one moment I was being attacked and I was like, I decided I was going to retreat. And I was like, as soon as I said, I'm going to retreat, the music was like, it just hit like this perfect moment. Like, yeah. So there were lots of things, lots of tension just from the awesome soundtrack for the movies. And yeah, we had a real blast playing this. And I'm definitely like looking forward to playing it more now that I've finally gotten it to the table.
That is great.
Yeah, have you ever played like War of the Ring or?
I haven't played War of the Ring. It's you know, I'm troops on a map, that kind of war. Like my favorite game in that, what I would consider that style, but it's a little lighter, is Kemet. I love.
Still haven't played Kemet.
Oh, see, yeah.
I know. I love Kemet.
It's in the desert too. Very different desert. But I loved. And honestly, I don't know anybody who owns War for Arrakis, but I have so many wargaming friends locally. In fact, one of the local conventions I help kind of organize around here is half of it's wargaming. So I suspect one of my friends would have this.
We'll pull you in.
If they're willing to teach me, if I don't have to read the rule book, I'm so in for a play of this. Yeah. It sounds amazing.
I definitely recommend, like if you're into Dune, like this is fantastic.
That's great.
Cool. So that is Dune War for Arrakis. And I guess one more thing I'll just throw in with this is I feel like I haven't played War of the Ring in a while. I love War of the Ring also, but I feel like this is like less complex than that.
Yeah. It makes sense that it might be a refinement. It's a much newer game and game design has improved over the last years and decades. And so I can see that being true. Yeah.
Yep. A little smoother, but very, very thematic. Awesome two-player game. So. Or, well, I'll try it with 3 and 4 eventually. Right on. So that's Dune, War for Arrakis. What else have you been playing, Suze?
So many great games. But one game that I played when I first got a little bit ago, and I'm revisiting it just because I love it so much, is Come Sail Away. Thematically quite different from Dune for Arrakis, War for Arrakis. But Come Sail Away, it was published last year, 2023. It's designed by Daryl Chow and Sashi, and it's published by Sashi and Sashi. And Sashi and Sashi is absolutely one of my all-time favorite publishers out of Japan. Every single game Sashi and Sashi publishes is at least good. And yeah. Chances are it's great. And that's just the way it
for
is.
For sure.
Plus, Come Sail Away plays 1-4, which again, hey-o, solo. Love that little solo nug in there. So Come Sail Away is all about filling a cruise ship. And that's another thing Sashi does so well, are just kind of little unique themes and settings. Yeah.
I just played the elevator in the elevator game. Yeah, yes. Yeah. I'm like, we are lining people up to get them on
and
elevators.
It works,
right? It was great. It's great.
And
yeah.
Like thematically, the actions make sense. I love this. Yes, totally. So Come Sail Away, you are filling up a little cruise ship. And it's dynamically built a little bit. You're going to be using tiles to build out the ship because they're different. The tiles represent different rooms, essentially. But everybody does the same setup. So it can be randomized for some variability, which absolutely does impact the gameplay. And there's some alternate rooms and things like that that make it more or less complex sometimes, things like that. And then you've got a bucket full of meeples in different colors that match the room colors for the most part. And then a little deck of cards that have different people illustrated on it. But really what those are all about, again, is the colors of the meeples. They align with the colors of the meeples. And this plays in a set number of rounds. And of course, whoever has the most points at the end of the game wins. Now, what people say the core mechanism of it is really Mancala inspired. Mm.
Nice.
So it's a drafting game in a way, but really it's more about getting these meeples and using that Mancala mechanism, because you're going to get two cards. You're going to pick one to play and one to pass. And then everybody gets a new card and you pick one to play and pass and so on and so forth. The way that this works is that the meeples on the people on the card align to the meeples that you'll pull out of the general pool. And then you must place those meeples one at a time into rooms on your ship, in the order that they appear on the card. You can play them left to right or right to left, but they must show up. You must place them in exactly that order.
Ah.
And then there are rules about you can go from one room to the next room, but you can't double back, and they have to move to an adjacent room. And you are dropping them off one by one into the rooms. And then all of these rooms have different conditions to score. So some rooms have, hey, here's a specific spot for a specific color meeple. Other rooms are a little more flexible. They'll have like little pairs of chairs with symbols, like icons on them. And what those are telling you is, hey, you can put any color in here, but they have to be the same color eventually.
Gotcha.
That kind of thing. And there's variable ones for that. And, you know, if you match a person to the specific room where there's a luggage icon, you have a luggage track that will unlock a little extra bonus for you, more rooms, that kind of thing. So it's just pick a card, pick your meeples, drop them off in order, try to fill up as efficiently and wonderfully as you can. If you put a person in the wrong color room, they go to, we call it the naughty bellboy, which is not what it is. But you get your own little bellboy placard and it's a -1 point and he looks very disappointed with you. And so you don't want to, you want to match him. And it is relatively quick to play and it is rules light, but it is so darn fun. Candace, it's cool. Just fun. It feels a little puzzly. It feels like you have a meaningful choice when you are drafting the card, but it's not overwhelming, right? You're just picking between two cards. That's all you're doing.
Yeah.
And I find that if you want kind of a nightcap game that's not too light, but not too heavy, that kind of thing.
Sure, sure.
It's such a great game. It's delightful. It's adorable. It's super duper fun. It's another winner from Sashi and Daryl Chow. Daryl Chow also co-designed another game with Sashi about Remember Our Trip that's phenomenal.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And so I've been pulling this out. I've taught it to a few people that hadn't played it before. They all love it. And it's just a real keeper. And you can get it. You can order it. Sashi did open up an online store directly that allows people in North America to order directly. So
awesome.
If you want to check it out, it's not in like distribution at game stores, but you can order it from them if you want to check it out. And I think maybe the Board Game Geek Store might have copies too.
We carry a lot of Sashi yeah. and Sashi games. So that is a good possibility.
There
I'm
you
not
go.
100% sure though.
Yeah. Have you played this one, Candace?
No, I haven't. But I'm like, as you're talking about it, I'm like, I really want to play it. I love like games, like you said, that are good for like a nightcap game that's like not too light, but like easy enough to break out, not going to break your brain, but has some like cool choices. I love games that use the Mancala mechanism. And also, this theme is just, I love it.
It's so adorable, right?
I love it. Yeah. Yeah.
I hope you get to give it a whirl.
Yeah.
It's definitely worth
checking
out.
It's on my list now.
Excellent. And that's
cool.
Come Sail Away.
Come Sail Away. Awesome. Awesome. Well, just last night, I played for only the second time ever Heat Pedal to the Metal. And this copy was provided to me by the publisher because I'm going to be interviewing one of the designers next week for Cardboard Creations.
Awesome.
But this is a racing game that came out in 2022, designed by Asger Harding Granerud and Daniel Skold Peterson. Published by Days of Wonder, so you know the production is fire. And it plays with 1 to 6 players. Again, it's a racing game. So we are racing cars around different tracks. Like the base game comes with four different tracks you can race on. And everybody's going to have their own deck of cards. And you have your little player board, which I love the art on these player boards because it looks like the inside of a car. You know, there's a spot for your deck. In the middle is your engine where you have these heat cards. You're going to start with most often 6 heat cards in the center. And then there's a space for your discard pile. And starting with whoever's in the front of the race, they're going to be moving their car first. But one of the things I like love about this game is the player board is so informative. Like things on the board, everything is so helpful. When I was teaching the game, I'm just like, just look at that. This iconography makes sense. You know, like everything makes sense. It's so clear. I really, really appreciate that. But the first thing that happens is players will simultaneously decide if they want to shift gears. So you have this little pawn that looks like a gear shifter and, you know, there's first gear, second gear, third gear, fourth gear. And that's going to correspond to the amount of speed cards you're going to get to play. But then you're going to pick, like, let's say I shift to third gear. I'm going to get to play 3 cards this round. So I'm going to put those cards face down. And then once everybody's done that, you know, shifted your gear and played your cards face down, then in turn order, we reveal them and we move. And the movement in this game is really cool because I feel like it feels like thematic, like with some of the choices you have, like when you're going around a corner, if your speed is too fast, you're going to burn more heat from your engine, which means you're going to put these heat cards into your discard pile, which will eventually get shuffled into your deck. But there are lots of cool things you can do with heat, like boosting. But if all your heat cards are in your deck, you're not going to be able to take advantage of the things that you can do for spending heat. Like if I'm in first gear and I want to jump 2 spaces up to third gear, I need to pay a heat. If I don't have the heat in my engine, I can't do that. So there's just like really, really cool aspect of just, you know, managing your heat. Also in your, besides the regular speed cards that have values, I think there are 3 of 1 through 4. Like there are 3 of each of those, and then there's 1, 0, and a 5. And this is the very like just base vanilla game. And then you get 3 stress cards, which I love the concept of stress cards because when you play them, you have to, and you can't like forcibly discard these. So you eventually have to play them. but you're going to have to randomly take a card from the top of your deck, another speed card. Sometimes you're like hoping for something. And like my friend was getting the first time he did it, he drew a zero. And it was like, oh, like that sucks. But yeah, I like all of the choices you have in the game for moving your car, like holding on to like certain cards to try to like pace yourself, make sure you take those corners nice and slowly, but then try to cut ahead. It feels like there's a lot of like tension and like, you know, sometimes, oh, I'm really far behind, but I'm catching up. So it like kind of like feels like it's an exciting race. And it's just really funny too, because the first time I played this, I played an early copy of it, you know, a couple months before it came out, and I played a 6-player game, and I remember being like, oh, that's okay. Mm-hmm. It's okay. And then I like kind of like heard about all the modules, and I was like, oh, okay. It's probably going to be like more exciting to me with the modules, because you can kind of like customize your car. So you people have asymmetric decks of abilities in there, and you can add weather and all sorts of different modules. So I kind of like walked away from that first game feeling lukewarm on it. Uh-huh. And then, you know, of course, it's a hot game, you know, a lot of people like love this game. And so I'm like happy to revisit it, because I discovered like, I really like it. I really like it. So I don't know if it was the first game was like too slow with 6 players, or, you know, maybe I was hungry, who knows, but I really liked it. And I'm like kind of excited to explore more of the modules. And then I also have the Heavy Rain expansion here to try.
Ooh.
So yeah, nice. So I'm pumped about that. And just trying, you know, messing with the weather. But have you played Heat, Suze?
So I have played Heat. Okay. And I gotta admit, it's a pass for me. Now, what I will say is, it's interesting to hear you say, oh, my first play was like fine. I remember it was all the hotness coming out of one of the conventions, and yeah. I thought, well, I gotta get Heat, right? And I was lucky to buy a copy when it was still in stock before it all sold out, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what I will say, and I think that they've actually adjusted it in the reprint, is I felt the rule book was rough, Candace. The rule book was really rough. And so our first play, we actually ended up playing something very, very wrong. And we had a lot of frustration. And really, like, the first game took like 3 hours.
Oh, no.
Right, which it should not take that long of a game. And then we were like, no, we want to like this game. We're going to give it another whirl. And unfortunately, in our next play, it just didn't fire off. Then we tried it with some of the modules, like with the weather, things like that. Ultimately, though, I don't know if we ever surmounted that first play experience frustration, yeah, because we started nitpicking every little thing.
Yeah, and I got you.
And what I realized is people coming out of the conventions that we're talking about, they were taught the game. So, you know, if you're taught the game and everything, but you're not kind of going through the rule book that was a little convoluted, for, in my opinion, then my first play experience might have been very different. I will also say I am a huge fan of Flamme Rouge. Have you played Flamme Rouge?
Yes, yes, yes. I used to own that. I loved, especially again, theme. So cool that you're bicycle riders and, you know, you have the drafting. The slip, what is it? Slipstream.
Yeah.
And you have that in this game too,
yep,
but it works differently.
Yes.
But yeah. Because this is one of the designers from Flamme
Rouge. It is, exactly right. And so for me, because I already own Flamme Rouge and I love Flamme Rouge, and some of the card management is similar. So it kind of scratched that mechanical itch and things like that.
For sure.
For me, I ended up preferring Flamme Rouge over Heat personally. But I am really glad that you've enjoyed it. And clearly, nobody's suffering from my experience. It's such a slam bam hit, you know, and I'm really happy for the designers, especially on this one.
Yeah. It is. And it is really like what you're saying about having that. If you have a bad experience with a game, you know, the first time, that can definitely.
It matters. It absolutely matters.
It matters going into future attempts or just not even wanting to.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I would say, like, to me, I'm not a crazy, like, I must have a lot of theme person. I'm probably in the middle, but I love unique themes. So for me, I love, you know, race cars.
Yeah.
It's whatever. It's kind of whatever. I definitely preferred the
bicycle racing.
The bicycles. Yeah. But there's something I love about like the decisions of managing your heat in this game that is just like really clever and just going around the corners. One of the things that I love too that they did graphic design wise on the board is they count down the spaces till the corner. Because you're trying not to go too fast around corners, so you can see how many spaces you are away from it easily without like counting every time.
That is a great detail.
So I definitely had like a way better experience with heat my second game. But the first time I was like, I didn't get it. I was like, why is everybody so like hyped for this?
I'm glad you stuck with it. I'm really glad you stuck with it.
Yeah, yeah. So that is Heat Pedal to the Metal. And now a word from our sponsor. The deck box that broke all records is in retail now. Following the huge success of its Kickstarter campaign, which became the most sought-after accessory ever, GameGenic is bringing this game-changing deck box to local game stores near you. I'm talking about the Academic. The Academic 133 Plus XL is a multifunctional premium deck box in a unique design that stores cards, tokens, dice, other deck boxes, slide card cases, oversized cards, boosters, life counters, and so much more. The lineup includes 5 special color designs, plus a bigger version, the Academic 266 Plus XL. All members of the Academic family are perfectly suited for a wide range of players. They're perfect for Magic the Gathering, Pokemon, Flesh and Blood, Keyforge, and many other standard-sized card games. GameGenic is known for revolutionary products, and this is no exception. Don't miss out on this must-have addition to your gaming setup. Head over to your friendly local game store and start your own journey today. Cool. Well, shall we jump into our list of meaty games in small packages?
Heck yes.
And I don't know about you. So like when I originally thought about this topic, I feel like I had a lot of games in mind. And then when I first sat down to think, I was like, I don't know. Like, and then of course I go over to the shelf, start looking around, and then I have a list that's so long and I'm like, oh, how do I even narrow? So I'll be very curious to see, like, you know, what games are on your list versus what games are on my list.
Totally.
You know, small is a very loose term. So I have different size. I actually wrote down the sizes of the boxes.
Oh, snap. Okay. You took it a step further than I did.
Just because I was kind of curious, more so, like, you know, to know, like, well, how many inches is that? Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, let's just get into it. I don't know. Like, I know you said you don't like ranking things.
I did. For you, Candace, I'll rank things.
Is your list ranked based on, like, which games you like the best or how much meat is compared to the small package? Like
I didn't think about ranking it that way. I actually ranked it just by my favorites.
Your favorites.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I think I kind of did like a little bit of a mixture, so we'll just see.
Well, and you know, in our little show notes doc here, you even say, and you just mentioned it, small is relative.
Yep.
Meaty is relative. And I think
that's true.
Like, for example, I was thinking about Arboretum. And Arboretum is a...
I thought about Arboretum also.
And it's a small card game, small box. It is... It's mean and it's cutthroat. Yeah. And I think the experience you get out of Arboretum is completely different than if you just see, oh, this cute little box with a little tree on it kind of thing. And ultimately, I didn't put it on my list, but, you know, it kind of spun me into this, what is meaty? And I feel like it's very relative.
Sure.
And it's, you know, we'll justify it for each of our games, I'm sure.
You know what? Yes, totally. And it's funny you bring up Arboretum because I considered it because I love it. But Arboretum made me think of another episode topic, whereas like other games, because you're right. Like when you look at Arboretum, you see these beautiful tree cards. You have no idea just from looking at the box and the cards what you're in for with that game.
Yep.
So I want to have like a whole think of other games like that. You know,
I love
like,
it. That'll
you know,
be fun.
Like Root. Like people thought Root was just going to be this
animals.
Little. Yeah.
Woodland Warriors. Oh, no.
Awesome. Well, let's jump to your number five.
All right. My number five meaty game in a small box. It's definitely a small box because it's the size of like a card game, like the Amigo style boxes. And it is Oh My Goods, also known as Royal Goods.
Good pick.
Thank you. This was published in 2015. It's designed by, hello, Alexander Pfister, published by Lookout Spiel, and it plays 2 to 4. Oh my gosh, Candace, when Royal Goods came out, oh, my heart went thump thump because I love worker placement. I love multi-use cards are so my jam. And here
Chef's
we
kiss.
Go. You've got a little mini worker placement resource management game in a single deck of cards. Say what? Right. So I think you pick this up and it looks like a Euro game has been shrunk down because I think it even has art by
the art. Yeah.
Not Dutre, but
It's someone who does
like
yeah,
all of the UVA Euros, right?
Very
I feel so
Euro,
bad I can't.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it looks like a big Euro was shrunk down to a little card box, definitely a small box, but it has multi-use cards. It has resource management. It has powers that you can build up. It has it even has efficient or inefficient worker options the way it works. It even has push your luck and resource chaining and efficiency engine building in an economic game in a card game. What? Because cards can be a resource. They have a building on it that you can use for powers. It has icons that contribute to the push your luck. Oh my gosh. So much going on in a single deck of cards, plus they expanded it. And Candace, when we were doing this topic, I had to go, I didn't know what year it was published, that kind of thing. I went into Board Game Geek to look up what year it was published, and I saw they've got a big box coming out with all the expansions together.
Oh, snap. Yep. I didn't know that.
I had no idea. So I am very, very excited. I own it all, but I'm still probably going to pick it up just to have that nice little package or whatever. But yeah, I think Oh My Goods, such a great game in general. It's just quote unquote a card game, but I don't think you look at this box and look, oh, it's a deck of cards and think I'm going to have an economic resource management worker placement game experience. Bam. There you go.
Wow, that is such a great pick, and I can't believe I didn't even think of it.
That's
why we're
working
together. That just goes to show you there are a lot. Yeah,
we're
working together here. Wow, yeah. And there's another game in that family.
Tibor the Baumaster.
Yes.
I was torn.
Is the English.
Yeah.
Tibor the Builder is the English. Yes, I love that game too. It's got like drafting, but the multi-use cards. Yeah, yeah. Cool. All right, well, my number five is a two-player only worker placement game called Targi.
Excellent.
Targi came out in 2012, designed by Andreas Steiger, and it's published by Cosmos. And this is a game that this is in an 8x8 kind of like box, you know, a very standard size small game box. But when you get this, so not only at the time, I don't think there were any two-player worker placement games probably when this game came out.
Yeah.
And it's still like super rare, but like it's so cool how it works. It's such a fantastic game because your game board is a grid of cards and the cards that are in the middle of the grid change from round to round. And you're alternating placing your workers on the edges on these border spaces. And there's a whole thing where at the end, after both players have placed both their workers out, you're going to resolve the action card or whatever the card says that's in the intersection of two of your workers. And it's just such a clever way to do two-player worker placement. Lots of like really, really tough choices because what you're trying to do basically is you're collecting resources to build this tableau of tribe cards that give you abilities and they're worth points. And then at the end of the game, also you get bonus points if you have like the same type in a row and or if you have different types. And there's this robber meeple that goes around the border that says you can't go there. And it just gives you like almost like a feed your people moment, because there are raids that happen periodically where you'll need to play resources. And if you can't or don't want to, you lose points. So it's just like this like really, really cool two-player worker placement game that's like, wow, in this little box.
An amazing choice. One of my all-time favorite games, two-player games for sure. I love this choice. And I love the game. It never crossed my mind to put it into this list. So see, I'm glad.
we're working together.
Beautiful.
We're working together. Now, I will also say I had a tough choice in this slot. I almost cheated because like all my games, like I feel like I have categories.
Yep.
But like I had a tough choice between this and I was also considering Seven Wonders Duel because, oh, that game. I love them both. I love them both. And so I'll just mention that was another consideration for this slot. Same size box.
Okay, if we're going to start cheating, I'm going to start cheating, Candace, because
yeah,
I can cheat.
Let's cheat.
Because I would have thought, I also thought about beer and bread. As soon as you said Target, I thought about beer and bread. But anyway.
When you said something earlier, I thought about beer and bread. Like earlier in our conversation, I was like, oh, yeah, that one too. All right, what's your number four?
My number four media game is small box, Village Rails. So Village Rails is definitely a smaller box. It's smaller than an 8x8. It's a little thicker than a deck box, but it's not a big box. And it was published in 2022. We've got the design team of Matthew Dunstan and Brett J. Gilbert, who I don't know if they're as household namey in the hobby yet, but they should be because they are a phenomenal design duo.
Yes. Yeah.
This one's published by Osprey and it plays 2 to 4. It is kind of a sister game to something called
Village Green.
Village Green. Thank you.
Yes.
Excellent job, Candace.
Yes.
And which was garden building and things like that. But here we have Rails, and you introduce Rails. I love pathing games. So bam, I'm in on Village Rails. And what this is, again, it's basically, it's almost all, it is all cards.
Cards, yeah.
And you're going to, and multi-use cards, because they're they've got trips on the back and rails on the front. And basically you're building out a grid of cards. And when you have a 3x4 grid of rail cards, the game's over kind of thing. You're drafting these cards and you can play them for the rails or you can play them for their trips. And this has another mechanism that I just love in board games. And you choose how you score. So these trip cards
when you put
them around the border, you're creating your grid and you put them on the border. Where you put that card will determine how this rail that starts from this card, how it will score. So maybe you're scoring for a certain icon, or maybe you're scoring for a length, or maybe you're scoring for a terrain type, whatever. But by placing those trip cards, you determine what your scoring is. Love that. Then you also have all these rail cards and they all have, you know, like a crisscross grid and they exit and enter all sorts of different ways, plus all the different icons that potentially impact your scoring. All of that winds up to be, you know, it's not a heavy game, but you can spend a lot of time on thinking and tactically.
Thinky, very puzzly.
Very puzzly. And you're adjusting constantly. No game feels identical because of all the variability that it introduces. It is incredibly clever. There's an economic element to it as well. So much goodness. In a very small box. But you're not going to sit down with this game and just go, oh, okay, well, that was a nice little 15-minute snack. You're going to be sitting there. You are thinking and you are agonizing over your card choices. And I think that's awesome.
Wow, another great pick.
Village Rails, baby.
I totally forgot about this one.
It's beautiful. Beautiful. What about your number
together.
Four?
All right, my number four. So my number four was another cheat because this publishing company has a series of games that are in small boxes, but I'm just going to call out one game for now, and that is 1902 Meliese from Looping Games. It's designed by Eloy Pujadas and Ferran Renalius. It came out in 2023, and it plays with 2 to 4 players, and in this game, we are competing to be the best assistant, helping George Méliès record his famous movie, A Trip to the Moon, which was the first science fiction movie. And this is a worker placement game with a bump mechanism where you bump each other's workers off. And everything in the game is very thematic. Like the actions you're going to be taking, you're going to be getting new scenes. And the scenes are these cards that look like, you know, they're double-sided. So there's a black and white side. And they're numbered too, because you got to put these scenes in sequence as you're making your movie. You're getting materials together for special effects. You're preparing sets. You're dressing actors and getting them positioned right for the scene, these scene cards you're trying to match up to. You're then recording the scene, and then other people, you can kind of like edit and cut and paste, you know, in the movie, like change the positioning of these scene cards. And when you put a scene out, you're going to put your little ticket stub, your player color ticket stub out there. And there at the end of the game, there's like, depending on the size of the scene and the amount of your contributions to it, you know, you get some points. Then you can also hand paint the scenes, color them. And then that's when you flip the card over. And Suze, I could paint one of your scenes. And if I paint one of yours, you can get a share from the producing company that's making the movie, which shares can be worth points at the end of the game as well. So it's just like this box is, did I go over the box size yet? No.
Yeah.
It's seven inches by like 4.5 inches by two.
Yep.
You know, it's this like small rectangular box with this game that just did all that stuff that I was just telling you about. You know, it's medium, lighter weight, but the theme is so good. I've only played it once and I wasn't like blown away, but like for what this game does, like with the cool theme in the size box that it is, and like all the detail that went into the like art and components and how well the theme ties to the mechanisms, it's like really, really cool. And yes, Looping Games has this like 1900 series. So I own 1998 ISS, still haven't played it. I demoed it like 2 years ago at Essen. And then 1987 Channel Tunnel. Like there's a whole bunch of games and they're these small rectangular boxes that just like, it's cool. So you're nodding your head. Have you played this one?
Oh yeah, I've played it. And and I appreciate that you're like, I only played it once and, you know, it didn't blow you away. I will say that you play it once and you figure out how all the pieces move together. There's that variable journal thing that gives you little powers that you can move up that changes up the game from game to game. And what I found is in subsequent plays after your first one, after you just figure out the flow of the game, you start paying attention to little nuances, like how you want to like, where do you want to target because of those tracks? And do you really want to use that track? Maybe it's not as beneficial to you as you thought it would. Or you're really looking at what other people are doing and you start planning ahead a little bit more about what scenes are available for you to take. So I love that. Yeah, your first play is kind of a game flow feel.
Yeah.
But I think that once you get into it, there are a lot of nuances, little details that you start paying attention to that makes it a little more strategic and one level deeper, I think, once you get into it a little bit more.
Awesome. Did you ever play any of the other ones?
Oh,
like
yeah.
1998
One of them
ISS?
May be on my list.
Okay. All right. Then we'll pause there. So that is 1902 Méliès. And like I said, like Looping Games just has a bunch of great games. Maybe we'll hear about another one soon.
Maybe. But not quite yet. Because three game, Candace, I'm a big, big fan of the Roland Wright style game.
Okay,
and
all right.
I can't do any game list without trying to work in at least one. And all Roland Wright games, virtually all Roland Wright games are small boxes. But
for
are
sure.
they meaty? Let's be fair. I love the genre, but I'm not going to call a lot of them meaty. There are meaty ones. Like, for example, this is not the game, but Hadrian's Wall. Hadrian's Wall, definitely a meaty game, Roland Wright game. Box is too big for this list, Candace. It's like bigger than an
You're
eight.
Right.
Too big.
It's too big
it's
for
a
this
big
list.
Boy.
Yep.
I gotta go smaller. But there is a smaller box. It's actually the largest box on my list. It's because it's one of those like 8x8 size boxes.
Yeah.
And this is Demeter. Demeter is a Roland Wright style game. It's a flip and write. It's card driven. It was published in 2020. It's designed by Mathieu Verdier, and it is published by Sorry We Are French. Je regrette. Je suis français. It's
beautiful, beautiful.
Its player count is 1 to 6. I have played, and it is phenomenal. So Demeter takes place in this sci-fi world that, sorry, We Are French has built up with a few of their games. And it's, you're in space, but you've discovered a planet with dinosaurs. It's space dinos.
Wow. Yeah. Awesome. Love it.
And so it's all about researching this planet and researching the dinosaurs and things like that. So you have this sheet and cards are going to get flipped over, and the cards are associated with actions that you can take in different areas. And then there are, you know, spots that you can fill in accordingly. There are tech tree elements. There are dinosaur species that you can discover. There are researchers that you're going to increment up to learn more to amplify your points. And Candace, remember what I said earlier about determining your own score? Demeter has an element. There are tracks that, depending on which ones you decide to increment, it will activate different elements of the sheet for scoring at the end of the game.
Cool. I don't think I've ever heard of this game.
You know, roll and rights are just an area that I dive into pretty heavily. So Demeter is absolutely not a, you know, this is not Yahtzee. And nothing wrong with Yahtzee. I love Yahtzee. But it definitely has some meat. You're not going to play this in under 40 minutes. And decisions feel meaningful. It's fun. You're doing dinosaurs. The way the cards work means you're mixing it up turn to turn. I love this game. It is a very solid, meaty roll and write game in a relatively small box. I advocate there's a sequel to it, Varuna, that makes it even harder and meaner, which, you know. But I'm a big, big fan of Demeter. And hey, if somebody listening, if this helps somebody, like maybe even you, Candace, discover this really cool roll and write game, I'm happy.
Yeah. Okay. So, full disclosure, I have never been a huge roll and write fanatic.
Sure.
And I did an episode in February with Antoine Balza, and he picked roll and writes because he loves them. And that kind of like sparked my curiosity to like play some more and figure out which ones might I really kind of resonate with me. So I did eventually, you know, and I also had family coming to town, and I was like, this will be a good time to like experiment with these games.
Yeah.
Because a lot of them are lighter, but of course, I like heavy games, you know.
Yes, so exactly.
I'm always like looking for like what is, you know, I'm looking for player interaction, some complexity. And so like this sounds really cool. I wrote it down.
Good.
I'm going to have to check this one out.
I hope you do.
For sure. And I was actually thinking in this vein, Fleet the Dice Game.
Sure.
Was on my initial long list. And the Raja's Dice Charmers.
That's a great, I love that one too. I love that game.
I really enjoyed that. Like I was like, this really distills that board game down to a roll and write. And it was, I really enjoyed that. So who knows, like in a year I might be like, I love roll and writes.
And it's okay, Candace, if you don't. But I bet, there are at least a few roll and writes out there that you'll enjoy.
Yeah, I'm going to check out Demeter.
Yeah.
Wow, that sounds cool.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. The next one on my list is a game I've talked about on this podcast once or twice before, and it is the smallest game on my list because it is a button chai wallet game. So it is literally a wallet size game made of, you know, a deck of like 18 cards, and it is called Battle Crest.
Oh, yes.
Battle Crest is a 2022 release designed by Dustin Dobson and Milan Zikovic. And again, it's published by Button Shy Games, who specialize in these wallet-sized games. This one is a two-player card-based tactical skirmish game, but with expansions and extra packs, you can play, like there's a solo mode expansion, and then you can also play, there is a way you can play with 1 to 4 players. This game has no randomness, perfect information, and it's very like reminiscent of something like Summoner Wars, where you're going to have cards that you're asymmetric heroes. Hello. Asymmetric heroes. Love that. Like there are so many different heroes because now there are lots of expansions. So, and all these heroes have their own play style, but you're going to be moving your hero around a map of cards. And again, this is like what it reminds me of Summoner Wars, because you're kind of like moving cards around a board, but there's no board. And the cards for your map are randomly set. So there's like some variability with where they're positioned every time you play. There's a new base game of Battlecrest. It's called Metrone.
Oh.
That just came out. Yeah. And it has new map cards, new heroes. Yeah. But like, I just love how clever this game is with how it uses cards. Like, you know, you have action cards. Each hero has their own action cards. When you use an action, you like exhaust it. And then there's this action where you can focus to unexhaust it, but it flips it over. And now the action card is different. You have like different types of attacks depending on, you know, ranged, melee, depending on if you're adjacent to certain map cards, like the land cards, it gives you some different abilities. But it just feels like this, like, really, like, I love games like this. Number one, that have a bunch of different asymmetric heroes that play differently. It like reminded me of the Gearlox in Too Many Bones, you know, so much different flavor and variety from the heroes. But like, I'm just blown away with what they do here with a small deck of cards. And, you know, like,
it's just
the
clever
fact that it's, yeah, it's so freaking clever. And the way you track your health in this game is really, really clever too. You have these this card that's kind of sliding down, and then it flips over when you hit and resets. And yeah, so Battlecrest is just it's a real banger. And there's a lot there. Like, even if you get every single pack, it's like it takes up no space.
For those of you listening, Candace just held up a fistful of wallet games. Do you have all of them just right there next to you?
I have all
That's
of them.
Hilarious.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, she's fanning them out. I love that. I'm so glad you brought these up, because I mean, there are other wallet games you could have selected as well, because there
For
are
sure.
a number of them that a number of them are light. You know, cute little light things, but they do such a great job. And I think that card limit inspires designers, and they come up with the most clever ways to use 18 cards. I love it. Great choice.
I love it. So cool. Thank you. All right. Jump into your number two.
Number dos. And I will say, I just want to say, I specifically excluded solo only games from my list. For whatever reason. So, like, for example, I just got my copy of Gloomhaven Buttons and Bugs and have cracked into that.
No, there's a lot of game in that little box.
You know, or like there's this game called Pulp Detective from Alban Viard Studios. That kind of, like, there are a lot of really meaty.
20 Strong?
20.
Have you played 20 Strong?
I love 20 Strong.
Yeah. When you mentioned solo games earlier, I was like, that would have been a good
one. Or Unreliable Wizard just fulfilled. That's a solo game where you're like dungeon delving, and it's a real small game out of Japan. It's amazing. So, yeah. I could do an entire solo game, right? So we're moving on. All right, moving on. But
we'll revisit that for next time we're together.
I love it. So my number two meaty game in a small box is Jiraku.
Oh, yes.
Jiraku was originally published in 2015 out of Taiwan. It's published by Moideas, which is a publisher I always keep an eye on. They come up with amazing games. Another one of their games, Symphony No. 9, was on my short list for this one.
I just recently found my copy like in a bin, and I'm like, I got to play this game again.
Yeah, it's so good.
I haven't played it in years, but yeah, I love it. Yeah.
And this one, Jiraku, is designed by Iroi Tsukinami and plays 3 to 4. This is a trick-taking area control game. Heyo, I love
it.
Candace,
I love
trick-taking.
That blend.
Love trick-taking.
Oh, me too.
My favorite.
Me too.
I mean, because I grew up, like, that's how I discovered games in the first place. When I was a kid, I grew up with my grandparents playing bridge. So, you know, this goes deep.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
And Jiraku, in its original publication, it's in a box that's like 4 inches by 6 inches. It's tiny.
Yeah,
now,
I have that box.
There are reprints that have upsized it, but originally Jiraku could literally fit in your pocket.
Yeah. Brilliant.
So you get a little board that has different vertical stripes that are the different regions, and each region has a little score marker because they're going to score different points depending on what round you are in. And then you have a non-standard little deck of cards. It's not a full 52. I don't know exactly how many cards. And you're going to play a trick-taking game. You have to follow suit. You have to play, you know, there's a lead. That card plays. You have to follow suit if you can, but you can break suit and that kind of thing. But one, the cards have special abilities that happen because you also have a bunch of cubes for this board, right? That represents your units. So when you play a card, you can put units onto the board or move units around depending on the value of your card. So if I play a four, I could put four units out. Cool. I could move, I could get four action points. Cool. So not only are you playing a card to get those that action, but it also contributes to your trick. And the highest value card played in the trick is going to win the trick. And if you win the trick, that determines a region you're going to score for that hand. What? Mm, oh my gosh.
So cool.
So much going on. Plus then at the end of the first round, you're going to score all of the regions. And they score differently depending on what round you're in, which is why you want to be moving these people around or you want to plan ahead. Hey, I want to be over here because the leftmost region, round one, 0 points, baby. Round three, 15 points.
Ooh.
You right?
Spicy.
How are you prioritizing? How are you playing?
Right.
How are, when you play the trick, am I playing to win the trick because I know I've got power in this region? Or am I playing lower because I actually don't want to win? I, you know, I want to move things, like whatever. There's so much going on, and in a pocket-sized box, it's amazing. Jiraku is a phenomenal, it'd be a phenomenal game in a big box. It's extra special in that teeny tiny box.
Because it can fit in that tiny box.
And you know, it's a decade old now. It's almost, you know, it's 2015 publication. It stands up. Not enough people have discovered Jiraku. More people need to play it because it is that special. It's a phenomenal game. So Jiraku, baby.
Yes.
And you're nodding along.
Great pick. Oh, yeah. It is such a banger. And I love, like, I love area majority scoring.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love trick taking. So I'm like, and the fact that, yes, the box is so small. It's like, it is a fantastic game. Not enough people do talk about it. But yeah.
Love it.
Oh, I love it too. Great pick.
Thank you.
Oh, there's so many of these games out there, you know?
And here we are at number one. I am so excited to hear what your number one is, Candace, because you're
I'm on my number two.
You're on your number two.
I'm behind you.
I'm behind you. Well, I'm so excited for your number one when it comes.
Okay. Cool. My number two is a card game. It is a little card game that sometimes is in big packages called Innovation.
Dang.
Innovation.
I'm embarrassed I didn't think about this.
Innovation is a 2010 release designed by Carl Chudik. The current version is published by Asmodee Games and Asmodee?
Asmodee
Games, because I was like, it almost sounded like Asmodee.
Exactly, yeah, Asmodee. Yeah.
Asmodee Games, there we go. It plays with 2 to 4 players, and this is an abstract civilization building card game where you're trying to claim a number of objectives to win. You have decks of cards that are representing 10 different ages, and they're like, you know, different technology kind of cards starting from like the early ages to medieval, industrial, to the digital modern age. Each card comes in one of 5 different colors, and they have symbols on them. And they'll have an effect. And I think every single card in this game is unique. So off the bat, there's like so much like variety and replay value. And you're sort of building these cards into a tableau. But each turn you have like 2 actions. And your action choices, one of the things I like really like about this is your action choices are simple. But then there's like a lot of complexity because of all the different cards and the card effects. But you can like draw a card from the current age. You can play a card, which is like melding it. And when you play a card that's the same color that you already have, you have to put it on top of the other card. At some point, there are splaying effects that'll let you slide it over so that you're revealing icons from the card that was placed beneath the other one. Not placed beneath, but sitting beneath. you can activate one of your card's abilities. And then there's a whole thing where if your opponent has more icons of a certain type for an ability than you, they get to take that action. I think they get to do it first. So you're constantly like paying attention to what other people are doing as you're adding cards to your tableau. I just like, I think it's such a cool game. And there's like so much variety with all the cards. There's player interaction, sometimes player interaction that a lot of that certain people don't like.
Yeah.
I had this. So as my cheat, I was like, you know, I was just like Carl Chudik games, you know, like
fair.
I've never played Motinai. I've had it on my shelf forever. I haven't played Motinai. I know some people prefer Motinai over Innovation. So I'm still like so curious to play that. And also, I don't know if you have tried his newest game, AGNC.
I have it. I backed it. I have not gotten it to the table yet.
Okay. So I've only played it once, and I played it with two players. So that one has like five different decks of cards representing the Athenians, Spartans, Cretans, Rhodians, and Ephesians. And these are multi-use cards. Every card in the game is like a unique island, and depending on like where you play it, it represents different things. Like it could be an island on the table, it could be goods, it could be a temple, it could represent people, boats, and you're doing all sorts of things. Again, like a very like kind of Carl Chudik style where these cards you're playing, you know, the game is mostly just cards, but they just like create this like really like kind of slightly complex experience. I did find a GNC to be slightly fidgety because you're doing a lot of tucking of cards, but I've only played it once and I've been like really curious to try it again because I have a couple friends who like love it. Like some people I know tried it, liked it, then kind of fell off. And then other people are like, they're trying to play it all the time. Like any player count, they love it. And so I really want to like play this one more too. So this was my like Carl Chudik category. And Innovation, I backed whatever that newest like deluxe, you know, deluxe crazy set that they, you know, they've done a lot of those over the years. But whatever the newest one is, I went for it. And Innovation is Eric Martin's favorite game.
Oh, I know. I'm aware. I never ever want to play Innovation with him. Right?
Terrifying,
I'm
just, right?
I'm terrified at the idea. I mean, I can handle losing a game, but I don't know if I can handle losing a game that intensely. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Have you played Motinai?
I have. I think I prefer Innovation, but they're both really, really solid. And I haven't played a GNC. I've heard feedback about it being a little fiddly as well.
Motinai,
whatever. I like it thematically. It's really, it's best at two, though. That's what I remember, is that you tried a different player count and you got played at two. But yeah,
gotcha.
Great choices. I mean, absolutely. Carl Chudik, the category, fair. I'm going to allow that cheat. That's totally fair.
Thank you. They all apply. Awesome. All right. Well, I'm excited to hear your number one.
Well, yeah. You kind of dove into it.
I have a hint.
Yeah, you have a hint. And that's totally fine because you were so spot on. And I'm so glad you picked 1902.
Foreshadowing, right?
I picked 1987 Channel Tunnel.
Yes. Can I tell you real quick why I'm excited that you picked this
one? Sure.
Because I bought this game like in 2019. And I think that was my first time going to Essen. I bought this game. Never played it, sold it.
Oh.
And then when I was buying 1902, I think, I rebought it. Because I'm like, I was reading about it. I learned it at some point. I still haven't played it. So I'm excited that you're going to tell me why I need to play it soon.
Well, and I mean, I'm really glad you picked this one up because this is 1902 I really enjoy as well. I think the entire 19XX series is a banger. I Hey, Candace, FYI, I believe Lupin is looking for better distribution in the States. So if you know anybody, love for this series to be spread near and far. And I think this is a good example of where the box size is amazing for so many reasons. But I think in the American market, at least, it causes it some marketing trouble because people don't know what they're getting into and they see a small box and they associate it with kind of a lighter game. And I'm like, no. These are Euros in a small box. And
yeah, so cool.
One thing I love about, I think the 19XX series in general is they aim to be very historical and very thematic. And I have played all of them except ISS, the newest 1998 ISS is the only one I haven't played. I like them all. I love many of them. But I do find they are all very thematic. And I love that in the rule books, they drop these little historical facts. So like in 1902, Méliès, the one of the little facts I loved was the colorizing element. You're colorizing these film segments. Thematic, mechanically cool for points and for, you know, share cards. But there's this little note in the rule book. 21 women hand-painted every single frame of the film using special, you know, alkaline inks, that kind of thing to make it happen.
It's wild.
I love those little tidbits. And I love how that ported into a mechanism. Cool. Anyway.
Yeah.
All that to say, you made a good choice, Candace. The whole 19XX series is excellent.
We both did.
1987 Channel Tunnel is about building the tunnel. It was published in 2019. The designers are Isra and Shay. And if those names don't pop out to you, they are the designers of Red Cathedral, which is a game that's really gotten a lot of attention. So solid design cred there and published.
Another relatively small box.
Yes. Good point. This is a two-player only worker placement game. And you play opposite sides. One player plays France, one player plays England, and you are working together to push towards the center to build, to dig the tunnel. Back in the day, for those of you old enough to remember, this was a big, big deal. There are a lot of elements to it that you're toggling. It has, thematic, multi-use cards. If you hear a reprise, I love those multi-use cards, right?
Ding, ding.
Yeah, exactly. Where, you know, they have actions on them that you can add on to. They have resources on them. They have flags for some set collection, potentially, all that other stuff. Plus, you have the worker placement spots. You have a little tech tree that you're managing. There's a little push your luck in it as well. Oh my gosh, right? Already so much going on. It is mostly cards. There's a little like cardboard placard for your player board, that kind of thing. And then there's discs, wooden discs that are your quote unquote workers. And here is the star of this game. It's this worker placement mechanism. You have a variety of workers in a variety of colors. You don't own a player color in this game. So you're going to randomly pull out a set of workers at the beginning of the game and stack them by color. So maybe I'll have two blue and three white and four orange or whatever. And then you use that stack of discs as your quote unquote worker. So you put that out and you take the action, whatever you want to do, however you're going to use the multi-use cards, claim it, take it, use it, store it, shove it, whatever, right? and then, cool. So you've done that turn. Now the next person goes back and forth and back and forth. Well, then you run out of workers, or do you? Because the bump mechanism that you were talking about in 192, something similar here, but I would argue better because you can take over a spot as long as your stack of workers is taller.
I love it.
So if Candace puts two blue workers out on a spot, I'm like, oh, I want it, but I have three orange workers. Cool. I'm going to come in with three orange workers and I get to take those two blue workers into my collection to add. So if I have two blue workers too, I'm adding those new two blue workers. So now I have a four stack
blue
for a power stack, right? Which adds a completely different element to the worker placement, a completely different way of thinking about worker placement and timing actions, the way you're assessing what your opponent has, what you know they're going to play, when are they going to play it, how are you going to reclaim those, that kind of thing. Oh my gosh, totally unique, incredibly clever.
I'm so
much
glad I bought this again.
Yeah, it's real good. I may be wrong, but I find one of the things I love about two-player only games is that restriction allows game designers to really focus their game design. And that's what I find here. Like, who knows how this would have worked as a four-player game? It probably wouldn't
have. Right.
But because it's got that tight two-player thing, thematically, it totally works. One player is playing France, one is playing Britain. You're pushing through, you're digging up rubble for points. All of this is very thematic. Another really weird thematic thing they pulled in is deviation. I guess that in real life, like the channel, the tunnel diggers, they had millimeters of latitude to go off course. Otherwise, their tunnels would not have matched up correctly for, you know, safety and all this other stuff. So there's even a deviation mechanism in this game. You have to keep your tunnel on track. It is cool, Candace.
I'm so excited about playing this. I'm going to break this one out like really soon.
Yeah.
This sounds like awesome. I have a question. With your different colored workers, do any actions, like, you, like, are you restricted on actions based on the colors, or is it literally just to have variation on, like, your stack?
If I recall correctly, it's mostly variation on stacks, so you can have that distinguishing. Okay. There are some cards and actions, I think, that play off of it a little bit, but yeah.
Yeah.
It's got a lot going
on.
I'm
stoked.
For that tiny, again, for that teeny tiny box.
Yep. Yep, that's the first looping game I bought. And again, I regret selling it, but that's why I bought it again, because I was like, no, this is really cool. I need to try this.
I look forward to hearing what you think about it when you get it to the table.
I will let you know. I'll let you know. That's awesome. I'm glad you picked that.
Well, here we are, finally.
And that is, that was 1987 Channel Tunnel. Yeah. And yeah, here we are on my last game. It may surprise you, maybe not, maybe probably will. It's a slightly deep cut. So this is my number one, not because it's like my favorite game on this list, but because it is the meatiest of all of the games on this list. And the box is 5x5x2. This is a release from 2019 called PAX Transhumanity.
Oh, sure.
Designed by Matt Eklund. It's published by Ion Game Design and Sierra Madre Games. 1 to 4 players. In this game, we are startup entrepreneurs in the not too distant future. And instead of like a lot of games that portray, you know, the future as like we destroyed the planet or there's a zombie apocalypse, like in this game, it assumes that humanity's doing okay. We're doing okay. And so we're going to be trying to make a living by like offering new ideas and visions and, you know, taking different technologies and everything. So off the bat, like, you know, this is different from a lot of PAX games because it's not historically based. It's futuristic. Also, like, PAX games are famous for having a card market. A lot of the time, the card market is 2 rows. In this case, you have 4 columns. So the card market works completely differently. And each column represents a different sphere. So there's like first world, developing world, the cloud, and outer space. And the market, again, unlike other PAX games, doesn't refill automatically. You have to take like an actual action, the research action, to like fill in cards. But these cards in this game have, you play them horizontally, and on the right and left end, there's a little border that's a color. I think most of them are like one color on the left side, a different color on the right side. And a big element of the game is there's this human progress splay. So here I go with another game where you're splaying cards. And in this game, you splay it such that you see the color end of the card, and the different colors represent different like disciplines. So when you have like a pair of colors that are the same, certain things happen. Or if you just have a pair, you know, a certain combination of colors touching in this splay, the players are gradually kind of building out, different things happen in the game. Like certain ideas in the market become viable and you can actually start like creating them. And then on top of that, one of the ways the game ends is you have these like 6 different regimes, but only one of them is active at a time. So it represents globalization, there's transbiology, group dynamics, computing, assembly, and paradigm shift. And it depends on the way this splay, this color splay is, whatever the last 3 cards is going to tell you which regime we're focused on. And so one of the ways the game can end is if somebody commercializes like a tipping point card matching, you know, whatever regime is the current regime. Each player has their own like little player board, this like finance board. And you have like on your player board, you have three sections of cubes that you're going to be like shifting up, down, middle, you know, and it's representing your capital, your wealth, and your debt. So in the game, you don't ever have any like real money, but it's representing the flow of money. And, you know, you're doing all sorts of stuff, syndicating ideas in the market to gain special abilities, commercializing previously syndicated ideas to start up companies or solve problems, hiring employees, importing ideas, like moving them from one sphere to another. Sometimes you're dealing with outraged activists. And again, you're like researching to repopulate cards. There's a lot going on with this game, and it's like mostly card driven. The game can end in four different ways, which is another thing that like keeps you on your toes, because depending on how the game ends, you score differently. So, you know, one of the ways you could just, if you establish your fifth company, you win automatically. Other ways are like, again, I talked about the regime scoring. That's commercializing a certain idea. Then there's like, if there are certain, like if there are five adjacent cards of the same discipline in that human progress play, it ends and you score points a certain way. So there's like lots of things to kind of keep you on your toes. It's very complex. It's very thematic, though, in like kind of like an abstract way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I the last time I played this, I won the game with a score of 2 points. I have no idea. I don't remember how it ended. This game is really unique. And it packs a lot of punch in this little tiny box, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if you've ever ventured to try this one or have seen it.
I've played others in like that family from Sierra Madre.
Series, yeah.
But I haven't played this one. And honestly, from your description, this one sounds most appealing to me. So that's very, very
yeah.
cool. I love it.
Yeah. Because you're not dealing with any of the weird historical views of.
Yeah, I love it. It you sounds know, really like, cool.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And like, you know, PAX Renaissance First Edition is like a real like meaty, crazy game in a small box. The original edition of PAX Premier. They have a new one, Ion, called PAX Illuminatin that I played. And again, it's a very similar size, small box. Mostly like everything, your whole map is built with cards and but there's so much you're doing with cards, and these are like heavier games.
Oh, they
you
are
know?
Very weighty. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I haven't played PAX Transhumanity in a while, but like just thinking about it and picking it for this list made me want to like revisit it. Cause it's such a unique design, such a unique design.
Absolutely. Very cool.
Thanks. That is PAX Transhumanity. I also, as an honorable mention, thought about Teach You.
Absolutely. And I think,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Teach You almost fits into that category of games like chess, that it is so simple, but it endless plays of it. And you never get sick of it, right? It is a classic game. It just fits into almost a different category to me. I love Teach You. I think that's a great, yeah. We could do a whole list on that one, too.
I know. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, you could really break this category into several categories. And I mean, I love that. Like, I love that there are so many meaty games that exist in these, like, smaller boxes. Like, it's just, yeah, it makes me want to, like, kind of, like, downsize my whole collection. Although, I'm not getting rid of Dune Warfare.
Seriously, right.
That's a huge box, and I'm keeping it. But I'll offset it with some of these smaller games.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully people who are listening have found out about at least one game that they haven't checked out before. And hopefully this does remind people to go ahead and scan those smaller boxes and maybe suspend some of your expectations sometimes about what kind of game fits into a box of a certain
For
size.
Sure.
Because there are just this list alone, and you and I were already talking about how many games we could have included. There are many very rich, and there's nothing wrong with a light, quick, snappy little game. I love those too. But there are so many games in a smaller box that'll give you that really hearty, fulfilling, rich, you just, game experience.
Yeah,
and hopefully somebody found one or two in this list to check out.
Yeah, and I'm sure I love people will hopefully comment in with other ones that we should check out.
Would love to, because it is true. I don't even, when I'm counting my collection, I don't even count the small boxes because they just kind of slide in. They fill in the gaps, right? So, when I'm judging myself on what I'm buying, I don't judge myself as harshly on small boxes. So I could add a few more.
Awesome, Suzanne. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm glad we finally could make this happen. Great topic. I really love talking to you about it. I love hearing your picks. And I'm so excited to play 1987 Channel Tunnel. And also Demeter.
Yeah.
That sounded super cool.
I hope you get to check it out.
Yeah. And hopefully, I will catch you at some point, IRL.
Oh, I'm sure. What conventions are you planning on being at this year?
Gen Con and Essen.
I will see you at Gen Con.
Awesome. Looking forward to bumping into you.
Excellent.
You've been listening to the Board Game Geek Podcast, produced and edited by Candace Harris. Special thanks to Matt Fonda for editing and mixing our music. Be sure to visit us on the web at BoardGameGeek.com. You can also find us on YouTube, Twitter, Blue Sky, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and Twitch under Board Game Geek. You can reach us by email at podcast@boardgamegeek.com. Thanks for listening, and happy